social media feed. However, experience and common sense tell us that these emotions and currents won't be put to rest easily after the election. The working class should be frontline advocates for policy changes that improve their economic well-being. Yet, our friends from the Topos Partnership and their research suggests the current presidential campaign environment indicates that these voters are vulnerable to nationalistic appeals. How these voters ultimately cast their ballots is less important than understanding the deeply held perceptions and fears that drive the working class, how they embrace their policies that analytically don't improve their circumstances. The more important part of the challenge is figuring out what to do about it. How do we engage the working class in a constructive conversation to engage with government, improve their lives, and the nation? While this conversation needs to ultimately lead to a policy agenda, it will only be powerful if it creates a new cultural common sense, one that fits their understanding of how things work, while inspiring them to engage in fighting for the right solutions. This member briefing will explore what roles foundations can play when conventional strategies, particularly communication and education, mobilization, or advocacy to move policies seem stuck. So over the next few slides, I will share some of the demographic, economic, and economic changes that are creating so much turmoil, and particularly focusing on our region and how we're grappling with it. Certainly a core constituency being appealed to is the white working class that feels, in some ways accurately, it has been left behind in an increasingly unbalanced economy. The slide shows you the non-metro employment, or rural, as we might want to think about it, is lagging metro employment. Economic security stoked by trickle-down intimidation tactics makes them likely to blame an economy that benefits, quote-unquote, the other, people of color, foreigners, liberal elites, and so on, at their expense. In addition, they feel distance from a government that appears to be run by a group of moneyed elites, causing them to feel more like subjects than citizens. The world that the white working class once knew is changing. People of color will become the majority of Americans mid-century. In 1980, the U.S. was 80% white. While the Pacific Northwest will lag the rest of the country in this demographic change, big changes are not that far off. As you can see from this slide, hopefully, in Washington and Alaska, people of color will be the majority population within 50 years. In all other states, people of color will be at least a third of the population. The disaffection and isolation of people who identify as white, non-college educated has political consequences. In the next slide, I will share some of the findings on quote-unquote Trump voters, really as a proxy for this group, and this is not as political commentary. Trying to understand the appeal of more nationalistic populist platform of Trump, it's important to understand that while these voters have higher incomes, they're not living as long and their children won't likely be as prosperous. The findings from a Gallup poll working paper that came out earlier this summer, looking at long-term tracking survey microdata, found that the Trump voters are less educated blue-collar voters, but with relatively high incomes. Their longevity and intergenerational mobility will be less, is likely their prospects are less, and they're disproportionately living in racially and culturally isolated zip codes and commuting zones. Pew has also found a large demographic change in these voter groups as well. This slide shows that in 1992, non-college educated whites were at least 3/5 of both Republican and Democratic voters, 67% and 59% respectively. Now, white voters without a college degree are only 32% of Democratic voters and 58% of Republican voters, or nearly 3 out of 5 for Republicans. Finally, just a little more demographic context setting before moving on to Meg. This chart shows how our region is significantly more rural than the rest of the country. Other differences abound from state to state in terms of income, educational attainment, and poverty. So I want to pause there and see if there are any questions. It doesn't look like, do we have any questions? Logistic or otherwise? I think we're okay. So I'm going to move on to Meg. Meg, again, is from the Topos Partnership, and she is going to share a little bit about what we know and what we don't know from the research that both Topos has conducted and other research that she has available.
Great. Thank you so much, Remy, and thank you everyone for giving me the opportunity to participate in this discussion. I am very glad to have an excuse to get away from the out of control train wreck that is our news these days and focus instead on the future. I think it is clear to everyone, including average Americans, that there is a real need to heal our democracy, and that anger, that frustration, the kinds of things that we're hearing in the campaign these days aren't going to go away after Election Day. It's not just about the alt-right. It's not just about a small sliver of the electorate. It's not even just about Trump. It really is about our culture. Division, polarization has been increasing. I thought 1994 was the worst I had seen with Newt Gingrich and his Contract for America. And of course, we've gotten steadily worse in each campaign since, it seems. Have we balanced out? Will things turn? I'm not quite so sure. Hopefully things have bottomed out. But whether or not we've bottomed out and things will turn naturally on their own, it's clear that Trump has brought to the forefront some ideas and feelings that have been on the rise. There are a lot of drivers, but I want to include a couple of new ones in the mix. If we could go to the next slide. I want to talk a bit about anxiety. And my remarks today, while I will often, is my voice okay now? While my remarks today will often talk about Trump or about Republicans, really this is not meant to be narrowly about the election or about Trump, because I do think that what we're seeing is something much deeper, much more about a level of anxiety, particularly among white working class rural men, that we need to be attentive to. Let me read you one quote from today's New York Times that I think actually says something really insightful about this. And in the last week, of course, the stereotypical remarks from Trump have turned away from being about race and religion to being about gender. and that's what this particular editorial is about. It's from Jared Yates Sexton writing, "Growing up in a factory family in small town Indiana, I led an uncertain life with only a few constants: fear of losing it all, frustration with a world out of our control, and the ever-present need to be a man, a phrase that always carried with it an air of responsibility and torment. To be a man was to maintain the appearance of toughness, to never let on that you were weak or in pain." I think that is pretty insightful in saying something not just about the recent scandals, but in general about what we're seeing in this anxious electorate. There are two types of drivers within anxiety that I want to touch on: economic and cultural anxiety, some real, some based on perception, and lack of control, and how we see that playing out. And again, throughout, I'll refer to Trump or party identification, and that's really not about the election. It's really about using those as proxies for this underlying dynamic we're seeing. A lot of what you're going to see isn't based on our own polling, so we can't slice and dice it the way I'd like to, ideally. It's based on other people's polling, so it's insufficient, but it gives us a sense of what's going on. If you can go to the next slide, please. So Trump's support is clearly driven by anxiety. Here are a couple of questions that give you a sense of the general anxiety that is more prevalent among Trump voters than Clinton voters. When asked, compared with 50 years ago, is life for people like you better or worse? 81% of Trump voters say worse, only 19% of Clinton voters say worse. When asked if the future of the next generation of Americans will be better or worse, 68% of Trump voters say worse, while only 30% of Clinton voters say worse. So generally, they have a very dark view of the present and a dark view of the future. White voters, less educated voters in particular, feel this level of anxiety. And interestingly enough, Trump voters are less likely to say that the U.S. can solve its problems. A majority believe they can, the U.S. can, but there's also this sense that there's not a whole lot that can be done to address some of the challenges they see. You could go to the next slide, please. In addition to this generalized anxiety, there is a sense of financial anxiety as well. When we look at people, Republicans, who have a favorable view of Trump, as well as an unfavorable view of Trump, you see trends where those who have a favorable view of Trump are more anxious financially. So among those with a favorable view of Trump, 67% say that they have been cutting back in their finances. That's 13 points higher than those with an unfavorable view. 59% of those with a favorable view don't feel good about the amount of spending money that they have. That's 17 points higher than those with an unfavorable view. And then just in general, 62% aren't feeling better about their financial situation. That's a whopping 23 points higher than those with an unfavorable view of Trump. So this is important because, as Remy noted, some of what we see may be driven by perception, not actually dollars. Perception of what they see happening in their communities, what they see as possibilities for the future, for their children, and so on, not just the actual dollars in their pocket. Let's go to the next slide and talk a little bit about some cultural anxiety as well. It's pretty clear that Republicans are particularly worried or have this sense of cultural disruption that is happening that is due in large part to changing demographics. So a majority of Republicans say that their own personal way of life is under threat from illegal immigrants from Mexico. Only 9% of Democrats feel that way. A majority of Republicans support a ban on immigration from any country with a history of terrorism. Only 16% of Democrats feel that way. And going further from a different poll, it's also pretty clear that Trump voters and less educated voters want Muslims in the U.S. to face more scrutiny. Muslims who live here in the U.S. to face more scrutiny. A majority feel that way. And they are less likely to say that diversity makes the U.S. a better place. So in addition to this financial anxiety, there's quite a lot of anxiety due to cultural disruption as well. But beyond the economic and cultural disruption, there is another driver of anxiety that I want to point to if we can go to the next slide. And that is a sense that they have very little control over their lives, their communities, over the nation. In our own survey by the Topos Partnership, we asked people what comes to mind when they hear the word government. And these are the kinds of things that they said: corrupt, divided, greedy, self-serving, selfish, control, power, and so on. These words are probably not a surprise to anyone on this call, but it goes much beyond just the idea that people feel negatively about government. Our work that we've been doing over several years now points to a much deeper sense that people feel a distance from government. They feel that it's not our government. If you go to the next slide, another one of the questions we asked in our survey was, do you tend to think of it as the government, our government, or we are government? And you can see here 75% are saying it's the government, this distant, separate thing. It's not about us. It's not our government. It's not that we, the people, are government. And this deep sense of distance is a major challenge that we have to deal with. If people are feeling anxiety and they have no control over the future, no control over their government, then there's no hope in their mind that things can get better. So if you go to the next slide, I mean, in summary, what we really see going on here is a big challenge to solve, if we can go to the next slide, is the sense that we are really subjects, not citizens. And Remy referenced this in his remarks as well, that it's elites who run the government, whether it's political elites, people with wealth and power. They have all the say-so. They control everything. The rest of us have very little say over what happens. Even when people are saying something positive that government has done, it's still about them, it, a distance, not us. This lack of control is really what we would say is a significant underlying central problem to resolve. If we resolve that sense of control, re-engage people with government, then we have much more opportunity to address all of these other symptoms that we see in people's attitudes. So if you go to the next slide, I want to talk a little bit about the relationship between control and views on government. A sense of efficacy is related, correlates with how people view government. And by efficacy, what I mean are two questions. That people believe government gives people a say, a voting gives people a say in their government, yay or nay, or that citizens can influence government, yay or nay. And when you take those ideas and you scale them, what you see is those who score low on efficacy, those who don't believe that voting gives people a say in government or that citizens can influence government, and you compare them to those who score high on efficacy, you see that those who rate low are far less likely to trust government, 17 points less likely. They're less likely to believe elected officials are honest, 19 points less likely. They're angrier with government by 14 points. They are more likely to believe that government is wasteful and inefficient by 19 points, and far more likely to say government needs very major reform by 26 points. So this is the punch in the nose group. This is the group that is so angry and they feel they have little control and they see their lives getting worse and they see the world changing around them and in their communities, and they don't feel that there's much of anything they can do about it. So clearly re-engaging people in government needs to be a primary goal. So if you can go to the next slide, ideally what we should all be working toward is reinvigorating this kind of model that you see on the screen. The idea that whether we're talking about citizenship and voting and speaking up in politics, whether we're talking about responsibility to pay taxes as a citizen, expressing views, even running for office, privatization, it doesn't matter what the issue is, that we, the people, are responsible together for building, managing, investing in those things that benefit all of us, and that we have to be wary of those with a lot of money and power taking over the system and ceding our authority to them. So all of the work that we've been doing over several years now, whether that's research on attitudes toward government, toward revenue, toward money in politics, toward privatization, points to the need for this new cultural common sense that restores a level of citizen action beyond simply voting. So if you go to the next slide, please. So I hope, I'm looking forward to a very rich discussion about all of this and hope that those few remarks gave you, you know, perhaps something new to think about and some ideas for how we can begin to repair our democracy after the election. So with that, I'll hand it over to Eric.
Hello, everyone. This is Eric Ward, Program Officer with Gender, Racial, and Ethnic Justice at the Ford Foundation. And thank you all for joining us for what I hope will be a very robust questions and comments as we tackle this question. You know, I reflect back on a story about Frederick Douglass in December 1867. He stood on a stage in the middle of winter in Boston, and he spoke from his dreams, and the speech was entitled Composite Nation. And he conjured a country that was unprecedented in world history. It recovering from the bloody trauma to end slavery, America was unique in its youth and in its democracy. But its multiracial population in 1867 unnerved many. And Douglass embraced the prospect of a multiracial nation with both trepidation and promise. And what he said was, the real trouble with us was never our system or form of government or the principles underlying it, but the peculiar composition of our people, the relations existing between them, and the compromising spirit which controlled the ruling power of the country. He goes on to say that we have for a long time hesitated to adopt and may refuse to adopt and carry out the only principle which can solve that difficulty to give us peace, strength, and security to this republic. And that principle is absolute equality. It is this question of equality that underlies much of the discussion that we are having today regarding demographic change in this country and demographic anxiety. We at the Ford Foundation are engaging this issue because it is so central to the question of equality in this country. I've often said, even from my times in the Pacific Northwest, where I organized in urban and rural communities for over a decade, that the real debates happening in the Pacific and Northwest were not really simply about immigration or English as a second language or criminal justice, that primarily what was happening was a discussion around who is an American and what would America look like. I reflect back in 1999 while I was working at the Northwest Coalition Against Malicious Harassment. We were based in Seattle and worked in six states in the Pacific Northwest. And our phones at the time were off hook. We were approaching, you know, what everyone had been talking about at that time, Y2K. You may remember Y2K. People were scared that computers were going to crash all around the world, plunge the world into a technological disaster. People were hoarding bags of rice and water and flour in their basements waiting for this day. And at the time, it corresponded with a growth in an armed paramilitary movement in the Pacific Northwest, not dissimilar to what we're seeing in Oregon, in Burns, Oregon, in terms of an armed militia movement that saw the federal government and elites above as a threat, and also saw what it claimed was a multicultural sludge pool of liberals and minorities and feminists from below who were seeking to destroy the fabric of America. Many of these folks had engaged in acts of violence and intimidation in the Pacific Northwest, targeting individuals who were just citizens and also government officials as well. The media was really concerned about this potential confrontation or that might happen with armed militias. And they were calling us to understand how these armed militias were responding to the year, to Y2K. And my response, I think, you know, wasn't as sexy. My response was, in fact, at that time, most of the hate groups and armed militia movements, patriot organizations, as they were called at the time, weren't talking about Y2K and the year 2000. The year that they were talking about and were in full-on discussion was the year 2050. And they talked and pointed to the year 2050 in their journals and in their magazines, in their discussions, as a critical moment in America and in American identity. And for them, it was the year that they believed that whites would no longer be the minority. In real census terms, what 2050 really reflected was that there would be no longer a clear racial majority in the United States. It's much more nuanced and complicated than the idea that whites would no longer be a minority. Why is it more nuanced? Because the idea that whites will be a minority in America presupposes a number of unresolved pieces. One is it presupposes that somehow on January 1st, 2050, that every marginalized community in the United States will all of a sudden get along and consider themselves one identity, that Latinos, Blacks, Asians, and Native Americans will see themselves as one unified identity, which is unlikely to happen. It also presupposes that all Latinos identify themselves as people of color, which is actually not correct. In the United States currently, about 90% of Latinos consider themselves white. If that trend continues, in fact, what we are going to see is not a growth of communities of color in the United States, but a growth actually of the white population because the Latino population, in fact, is growing. The idea of demographic change in America is actually quite complicated when you look at realistic data around what it means. But as funders, we know that reality is only one worldview, and that there is another worldview that really sees itself as under threat, and that is the white community. We talk about it as disaffected white working class communities, but the truth of the matter is that there are more disaffected there is a more disaffected white population simply because there are more working class people in the U.S. In fact, when we look at data, what we will see is that there is a fairly even slice of the white population who feels that it is disaffected. It is not merely restricted to working class, middle and upper class whites who also feel this. In fact, in recent studies and polling that have been done, there are a growing number of white Americans who believe that they are suffering significant amounts of discrimination in the United States. While the white working class believes this, the numbers are not so diverse. So opinions around the idea of reverse discrimination, that whites are feeling and experiencing deep discrimination, have remained fairly constant over the past few years. About 50% of white Americans believe that discrimination against whites has become a big problem today, as big as discrimination against Blacks and other minorities. And that includes about 60% of white working Americans. So what do all these numbers mean? What I would like to argue is that what we are seeing has less to do with reality than an existential crisis, and an existential crisis around identity in America. What does citizenship mean? What does national identity mean? And what does civil rights mean? And in this perceived demographic change, what we have seen is the growth of demographic anxiety. And demographic anxiety expresses itself around the integration within the U.S. society in terms of equality of all marginalized communities and communities as a whole. Demographic anxiety expresses itself in terms of backlash around some of the gains that have been made in terms of equity and equality in American society. And finally, demographic anxiety expresses itself around the notion that as a result of equality, that whites are losing their place. And we have heard this during this present election cycle in terms of that it is important to make America great again. And in most polling, white Americans point back to the 1950s as an idyllic period in American life, and that American life has deteriorated since the 1950s, which correlates with the rise of the civil rights movement. So what does this mean for us as funders? As funders, I think it is really important that we engage this anxiety, that it doesn't matter whether it is grounded in reality or hard facts, that we realize that the anxiety may be existential, but it means that it still must be managed and dealt with. And that what we understand is that this anxiety is fueling much of the public policy discussions that we are having in America today. That much of the policy discussions happening have very little to do with addressing and fixing systems, but people's desire to understand where they sit and what their identity means as this nation moves forward. We believe at the Ford Foundation that there are at least some learnings and opportunities to begin to move forward. One is to understand what models out there currently exist, both in opportunity and challenge. The Pacific Northwest, for funders who are from there, I think provides a unique opportunity. It, because of the demographics in the region, which are largely white, it provides a landscape actually to test learnings, to understand challenges and opportunities that other places in the country simply don't have. Because of history or because of the demographic changes. We have seen this through the work of organizations out there such as One America, the Center for Intercultural Organizing, Unite Oregon, Organizing Project, and CASA, just to name a few. But there are many examples in the Pacific Northwest of organizations grappling with demographic anxiety. And I want to talk about what some of the challenges are in these last few moments that I think we as funders should continue to address. Challenge number one, the issue of integration and what does racial integration look like? That varies amongst demographic populations. For the white community, data shows that they believe that integration constitutes a community or a scenario that is made up of 90% white Americans and 10% minorities. That is, in the minds of most white Americans, the conceptualization of integration. When you talk to African Americans, they often define integration as 50% African American, and then 50% white and other ethnic or racial groups. Neither of these are realistic, but it does give us some idea that even when we use some familiar language like integration, how communities may be conceptualizing that data is very different. And so one of the challenges for foundations and groups in the field is, how do we invest in research so that we actually understand what communities and individuals are conceptualizing when they hear us speak in a language of equity, equality, and opportunity? The second challenge, demographic growth actually increases demographic anxiety. And we have seen this laid out in some studies on gender in the workplace, which showed that as women increase their presence by percentage in the workforce, that demographic anxiety amongst men actually increased. And in fact, it did not level out at 50% at parity. In fact, demographic anxiety then began to skyrocket. So as funders, we have to understand that we need to have a long-term strategic understanding of demographic change, understanding that this is not some scenario where once we reach parity, everyone is going to figure it and get along, but that in fact, as we reach demographic change in this country, that anxiety is likely to increase. The third challenge, and then we'll come to an end here, is to understand that the urban and rural splits in this country are significant, and we have to respond to them. And that these urban and rural splits are not simply by states, but within states themselves. The gap is so stark that some of America's bluest cities are located in America's reddest states. In fact, every one of Texas's major cities, Austin, Dallas, Houston, San Antonio, voted Democratic in 2012, the second consecutive presidential election in which they have done so. But no one would refer to Texas as a blue state. They would refer to it as a red state. And we see this across the nation. Understanding the nuances of rural and urban interconnectedness are very important. So what are the opportunities? The opportunities are that funders begin to shift how they think about their funding. And this means coming up with a strategy to engage white demographics. That should be done first by consolidating those white constituencies that are already committed or sympathetic to the idea of demographic change and managing demographic anxiety. Second, we need to understand the nuances of white demographics. Not all white folks are the same. They have different worldviews, and we need to understand what the varying worldviews are. Three, we have to understand, like the rest and the majority of Americans, the white working class is also suffering. Maybe not at the same level of disparity as minority communities, but they are suffering nonetheless. And it needs to be acknowledged, and we need to figure out ways to integrate them in some of the broader social change work that is going. Again, Oregon has a host of examples of that being done in different spaces, but we have to equip organizations and leaders of color to have the resources to begin to engage white constituencies, to not simply box in color as only being responsible for organizing their own specific communities. That does not reconceptualize what our country looks like, nor does it give voice and power to a changing demographic country that needs to see leadership of color that sees itself as speaking to the voice of the entire nation, regardless if it's a disaffected 78-year-old white male who is facing job discrimination or a 19-year-old African-American male who is suffering from the criminal justice system. It is one of the most robust conversations of our era, and looking forward to engaging with all of you as we move forward.
Thank you, Eric, for laying out such a robust agenda for philanthropy in dealing with these challenges. I want to move to Jesse from the Northwest Health Foundation, which will he'll share with us a little bit more about what is happening in the Pacific Northwest and a couple of case studies from the work that they are engaged in their region as well. So we will flip to Jesse momentarily. Go ahead, Jesse.
All right. Good morning or good afternoon, everyone, depending on where you're at. Thank you so much, Eric, for laying that out. My hope is that today I am able to present a couple of local examples here in Oregon that sort of respond to what both Meg and Eric have talked about. First off, for myself, the helpful analogy that I've been thinking about these past couple of weeks since seeing George Packer, New Yorker author, and he has a new book out called The Unwinding, and he said it's not about left versus right, it's about up versus down. And we've heard that in both Eric's comments and Meg's, that there's a sense of elitism being really in control of our government, and that those who are not part of that circle are disaffected, kept out, and their financial prospects and economic prospects are less. So for me, that's been helpful. Next slide, please. But I'm going to talk about two different examples here in Oregon. In terms of the opportunity to move a new narrative. First off, the growing militia or patriot movement here in Oregon and also nationally. So I think most prominent in many folks' minds example of this was the Malheur Wildlife Refuge occupation that happened earlier this year, which really I think brought to a head the growing patriot movement. And I think what's important to note about that particular occupation is that nationally the occupiers became the dominant story, and what was lost in that whole narrative was just how adamant local folks were against the occupation. There was a rally of over 350 people organized to tell the occupiers that they were not welcome. This is in a county of 8,000 people. So it is true that there is growing anxiety. And it is also true that people don't necessarily agree with the tactics that the Patriot movement is using. I think the other thing to note about the work of the growing Patriot movement is that it's growing. It is increasingly more sophisticated, and they are making the kinds of investments in infrastructure that we simply aren't yet making at the level we need to. And they're also stepping in to fill a void that in the disinvestment of rural communities, both in the private sector, but also in particular the public sector, that they're stepping in to replace policing and critical community services. And they're really presenting themselves as a new way of running communities. For instance, and they're seeing support from law enforcement. For instance, we've had at least one sheriff here who's deputized over 70 people in his county to effectively carry the rule of law around, which some people would refer to as a posse. We're also seeing domestic violence survivors being told by judges that they should get a gun because that's about the only way they're going to be able to protect themselves, because there just simply isn't the law enforcement infrastructure. So the Patriot movement is filling a kind of void for some folks, but of course they're bringing along with it views that are xenophobic, or Islamophobic, and really implicitly racist. And communities are often faced with these folks without a lot of ways to respond. But I think encouragingly, there are ways to fight back against it. Next slide, please. So the Eric mentioned them briefly, but the Rural Organizing Project has recently released a toolkit called Up in Arms, which is a guide to the Patriot Movement here in Oregon, but also has implications for other states in the Pacific Northwest. They created this toolkit for a couple of reasons. One, they were seeing that many communities felt isolated in tackling this. They thought maybe they were the only town where this was happening. There was a great sense of fear to speak up and out. These are folks who are armed all the time and openly carry. And to push up against them, people felt a real fear, and indeed a fear for their life. There were a lot of threats there. So the toolkit was designed to give examples of how communities have safely responded to this threatening atmosphere, and also to give rural communities ways of counteracting the Patriot Movement's talking points, which has been very effective for folks to have a way to push back, in particular in the media, to suggest that this movement actually is not as large as the media might portray it to be, and that communities are not simply sitting back and allowing this to happen. And they took this toolkit on the road. In fact, just this month have held meetings across the state where they are seeing 40 to 80 people show up in each of these meetings, which in a small rural town is quite a significant turnout. People are very interested in figuring out how to address this issue. And they are highly facilitated conversations with folks where sometimes they have folks from the Patriot movement threatening to come, showing up to these meetings, but oftentimes refusing to participate in a discussion and leaving. And so, but the folks that remain are very interested in figuring out how they collectively organize and push back against this growing movement. And I think they're also very interested in the long-term prospects of their rural economy. And that's really the conversation that they want to have. And they feel like the Patriot Movement is hijacking their ability to talk about the future that they really want for their communities. And I think, as we saw in Burns during the occupation, that people want to speak out and say, this is not how I want to solve our community's problems. But I think to a point that Eric made, all of this takes organizing infrastructure that exists in part to push back against the Patriot Movement's infrastructure. So the kinds of investments that foundations make in groups like Rural Organizing Project are critical to consistently push back and present a new kind of narrative in rural communities. And with my remaining time, I'm going to talk about another project. So next slide, please. The other thing I think Eric mentioned as well, is that Oregon is a unique state for a few reasons. We're generally regarded as progressive, but we have been the battleground for anti-choice and homophobic ballot measures for decades. And most recently in 2014, the ballot measure to overturn the driver's cards, which would allow any driver, regardless of documentation, to drive on our roads, was overturned with an overwhelming majority of 68% of voters. So what that shows us is that despite notions of progressivity, when it comes to this issue of immigration, there is somewhere in the progressive voter or middle, a group of folks who are feeling anxiety around immigration. And of course, it doesn't help that we are home to one of the most active nationalist organizations that even the Southern Poverty Law Center recognizes as a hate group. And this group Oregonians for Immigration Reform have consistently tried to get anti-immigrant ballot measures on our ballot. Despite some success in 2016 keeping them off the ballot, they are already filed and ready to come back in 2018. So these continued attacks to us call for a new approach. We know that anti-immigrant activists will continue to target immigrant and refugees communities as long as they feel that they have the fertile ground, if you will, amongst the general public. And so what we've made an investment in is a group called One Oregon. It's really a coalition of many of the leading immigrant and refugee organizations, along with our largest LGBT organization and our 501c3 state table. Civic engagement table. And they've come together to advance a broad values-based vision of inclusion of immigrant refugee communities that's based in tested messages and strategies. This project has a lot of good things going for it. I think a key one is that during the long battle for same-sex marriage, Oregon actually led the state-based work on the narrative shift in marriage from one of fairness to one of love and commitment. And so we have a lot of knowledge and infrastructure here around how to do that over time, how to do that long-term work. And we also have a great group of organizations that are pretty good at working together. And the project is just getting started now, and it will be two phases. And the first phase is messaging research. And the second phase will be public education through intensive media, but really intensive field outreach on the kinds of community conversations that we know take time, but are also critical to helping change the narrative and really see a shift in culture among the movable middle. Next slide. So the framing questions that our first phase of messaging research is designed to do is, one, help us identify who is the movable audience. Two, what are the big picture values that these movable voters feel connected to? That effectively move them in a conversation around immigration and in particular undocumented immigrants. We want to understand the effects of the existing messages that are out there driven by both proponents and opponents. And we want to know what stories, if any, of undocumented immigrants build support for immigration reform broadly at a national level, but also around just how we view immigrants here in our state. We also want to know how do movable voters' attitudes around immigration relate to their attitudes around race? How closely do people see these things or make these connections in their minds? I think all of this goes to both what Meg and Eric have been talking about is the idea, the opportunity to shift the culture. And in particular around this issue, I think before many of these values or many of these ideas or perceptions around immigration become too entrenched in the movable middle. So I think with our timing, our hope is that we can get ahead of the issue before we really see a hardening for folks over time. And I think, next slide, if folks are more interested in learning more about the project, we are doing a partner briefing in the first week of December. You can get to it from there. I think with that, I am turning it back over to Meg.
Actually, I think Remy may have wanted to break at this point to see if folks have any questions. Is that right, Remy?
So thanks, Meg. And actually, I do want to encourage folks to start sending questions to us by the chat function so that when we break for the discussion after Meg, we can have some lined up and ready to go. Thank you, Jesse, for sort of moving us in the solutions orientation. Meg is going to talk about some of the research that Topos has conducted that really underscores there are openings to change culture. So I want to turn it back over to Meg, who's going to walk us through some of the research that Topos has been able to uncover and show us a little bit of that in action. So thanks, Meg.
Great. Apologies for the hiccup in presentation order. This is just really quick. I think so many great remarks and examples by Jesse and such rich, thoughtful ideas shared by Eric. I really just wanted to share something very quick, which is, you know, we've all talked a little bit about anxiety and inequality and how much of this is based on reality, how much of this is based on perception. I thought it might be useful to share one example of an opening for a progressive conversation, even in a place that might seem the most challenging and most difficult. So I know this is in Pacific Northwest video, but I grabbed some video from work we've been doing in Appalachia as an example of, you know, here you have rural, white, working class folks who, the coal industry is leaving, they're really struggling. So it's not just perception, it is reality that they have a lot of financial anxiety. I think it is very easy to assume that they don't know what's best for them, or they're very closed-minded and backwards, or that they're independent bootstrap. They don't care about anything other than them. I think it's easy to assume that they're very tribal in their thinking, very closed-minded and tribal in their thinking. But when you really listen, there are openings for a positive agenda. There are openings for some common ground policies. And I just take a second to show you this video, and then we can talk a little bit about the common themes and what I mean by openings for common ground. Go ahead.
We can all work at a retail place and sell each other back and forth our retail stuff, but that has to end at some point because there's not enough money to do that. I mean, if I work at a retail establishment and everybody else does too, none of us are making enough money to support all these other businesses. It has been our one base industry here that has supported everything.
I'm the one that ground make the payday. I'm coming out here, I'm spending it. Here, yonder, you know. So actually, my payday's everybody's payday. You take my payday away and you tuck everybody's payday away pretty much. And that's what's happened.
These companies coming in like Walmart, they pay minimum wage for 20 hours, 28 hours, something, so they don't have to pay any benefits. And every dollar that they make is gone. So you're taking millions and millions of dollars out of Eastern Kentucky or Appalachia, shipped it to Arkansas. What comes back? Nothing comes back. So that's why I'm saying it has to come back. Something has to come back in order for us to really boom and grow.
The hospital.
Excellent. Great. I just wanted to show a minute of that video. That's based on ethnographic research that we conduct, where we go into communities, we grab people in coffee shops and street corners, and we get in these very authentic conversations with folks where you can hear their uncertainties and worries and so on, and really get at some of the underlying unconscious models. And so part of what we learned in this process is that there are some areas of opportunity even in tough communities like that, to say what you heard from these folks is an idea that, you know, we rely on each other here. My payday is everybody's payday. We rely on each other. Our fates are linked. It doesn't matter if you have a job at Walmart, if all that money is just going to Arkansas instead of staying here. So coal is the means to a thriving community and prosperity. It's not the end. It's not that they're all live and die on coal. So when you really listen and you listen to these authentic voices, their anxiety makes sense. And there are certainly opportunities for common ground and the kind of progressive economic agenda that can make a difference in rural communities' lives. So I just wanted to share that as just a quick little upbeat closer that, you know, we really do have opportunities for a more hopeful progress in even in some of the toughest communities or seemingly toughest communities for the kind of conversations we want to have.
Thanks, Meg. That's a great kickoff to our moderated discussion. Again, I really encourage folks to send questions our way so that I can add them to our conversation. As we get them, I'll insert them into our discussion. So now all four of us should be unmuted, Jesse, Eric, Meg, and I. I'm actually curious just to start the conversation about the leadership role for foundations. It's been my observation that the foundations, in trying to move towards a more solutions orientation, many are providing leadership that way. There are oftentimes foundations that are actually unintentionally, sometimes intentionally, making the work harder around culture change because they're promoting narratives and communications that that promote negative perceptions. So for our foundation folks, Jesse and Eric, I'm curious if you could weigh in on how your foundations and foundations in particular can model effective communications and organizing strategies that move the culture in a more positive direction. Jesse looks like he's thinking very deeply about that.
Well, I'm wondering a little bit more if you could expound on what you mean by foundations supporting work that continues negative perceptions.
Well, I'm curious, particularly around communications, just weigh in on the role in which your own foundation can promote communications that help change culture. And then I think Eric as well, I'm curious about how your own communications that come out from the foundations versus the things that you're funding with grantees can help move culture in a more positive direction.
Well, I think for us that we've really come to respect the role of messaging and testing, particularly in the local environment. I think national messaging work is super helpful as a foundation, as a place to build from, but we've just seen so often that the locality changes how people perceive things and the kinds of conversations you can have. And I think we have realized that we haven't resourced organizations enough to do that kind of important work. And so they've been sort of inventing the messages that feel good to them. And so they might be perpetuating negative perceptions unintentionally because, you know, they think that messages move them. The other piece that I would say is, you know, this was, and we saw this on the driver's card, was there was a real tension, and we saw it 10 years ago in same-sex marriage, there's a real tension between the particular issue before the electorate, which was driver's cards. And so the messaging around, we just want to be safe on the road, and everyone wants to be safe on the road, versus the need to really address what was underlying that 68% of people voting to overturn it. Because talk about voting against your own interests, right? We are. My car is better protected if the insured rate of drivers, if I'm likely to get hit by someone who doesn't have a driver's card, I'm likely to. You know, face that issue of you know, the craziness that is a car accident. So I think that Latino communities wanted to have a broader conversation and say, we are really talking about anxiety around immigration. And the people running the campaign said, no, we have a tiny message here about safety. So I think the tension around, are you addressing something big or are you addressing a very narrow thing? And then I think the other piece is figuring out on this question of immigration or anxiety, are we trying to pivot people to a larger question about what the underlying problem is in our democracy, right? Or our economic structures, right? Are we trying to say, you're blaming immigration, but it's really wealth inequality, or are we just trying to have a conversation to shift them on immigration? And that, if we don't invest in the right kind of narrative work, message testing, and understanding of where people actually are, then we're going to keep unintentionally doing things that don't help us.
Thanks, Jesse. Eric, do you want to weigh in on this?
So this is Eric. Can folks hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, perfect. So, you know, in terms of you know, culture, you know, I would just share three things. So, you know, the Ford Foundation, as you know, is very invested in culture. We think it is a key component in transmitting knowledge, transmitting stories, inspiring individuals, and you know, as education, right? And it's not simply a tool. It is one of the ways that we express ourselves in this society, and it is one of the ways that we shape society. And so we are very committed. Now, I think communications is important. I think that in light of where disaffected communities, including disaffected white communities, sit, there is a lot of suspicion that communications is much less about trying to have authentic conversation and is much more geared towards manipulation, mm-hmm. right? And so it is seen not as a tool of authentic democracy right now, but more as a tool of manipulation and domination. And so I think, you know, there are challenges in terms of communications, but I think it is important in those ways that communications are about understanding the constituencies that we're speaking to or engaging. I think it just cannot be understated. There's narrative too, and narrative as the second piece of these three, I think is also important. And narrative is different than communication. So, you know, narrative is about lifting up and shaping stories that I think help us conceptualize our common identities and common struggles that, you know, move us outside of our siloed identities, move us out of the idea that strengthening democracy is a progressive platform, and moving it into a space where it should more properly sit. This is not a left-right problem, right? This is about reshaping and understanding national identity in vibrant ways that move us forward together. And narratives are much more about shaping stories than shaping arguments. It's much more about shaping our commonalities, and I think much more investment needs to occur in narrative than we possibly have done to date within philanthropy. And there's some interesting examples of that happening in a number of spaces in philanthropy. The third is this. The third is that, you know, this idea of there's a great book that is coming out from Oxford by K. Sabil Raham called Democracy Against Domination. And it is a look at how this top-down structure in some ways exasperates some of the demographic anxiety that's happening. I think a disrespect of real organic American culture in a number of ways. So, you know, we see it in the stereotypes that, you know, every Trump follower must be a pickup truck driving, Budweiser can, drinking, you know, poor, white person with no education. I mean, it's simply not true. People are turning to Trump for a number of reasons. Some of that is bigotry, but some of that is that people feel alienated and want something different. People feel disaffected from their society. They feel disaffected and detached from their institutions. And whether that is real or not, again, doesn't matter. It's existential. And people believe it and will act accordingly. And our response to the belief that that one is falling is not to simply stand back and tell people, but you're not falling because I'm doing well. It is to understand that people want something different and to continue to provide the status quo as the answer will only provide fuel for demagogues who will seek to organize those who feel disaffected. And so the third way that culture really plays a role is to reshape, you know, who we have as leaders and who we allow to be leaders. And the over-professionalization of social change is a detriment in many ways to our attempts to engage this slice of the population. They are redeemable, right? So we saw the majority of white working class folks vote against Proposition 200, the anti-immigrant bill in Arizona. We have seen white constituencies, because they're poor, because they don't have access to education, does not necessarily mean that they are embracers of exclusive and exclusion style democracies. It just means no one has gone out to compete for that constituency, and we need culture to compete for that constituency.
Thank you. So going with this concept of culture, Meg, I'd love you to talk a little bit more about the work that Topos does and just the evidence that culture-changing communication can be effective. Jesse laid out the work around marriage equality, the shift around the communications component of it, but how it actually, the narrative work helped underscore the culture-changing component of moving our country and different states to a different place. So if you can weigh in on Topos's work, some of the evidence, some of the things that we're finding in the research that
Yeah, and I'll give one quick example of a success, and then want to lay out a thought that builds on what Jesse and Eric were just talking about. Something to consider is communications to what end? You know, what are you really trying to do with your communication strategy? And if all we're trying to do, this is directly to the point that Eric and Jesse were talking about, if all we're trying to do is convince people they're wrong or make them feel better about something without any real change, then that's a disservice to our nation, to our issue. And so the example I want to give is work funded by the Ford Foundation, where the basic challenge that emerged is the way people think about the flow of money in our society. Even though everyone laughs at trickle down, they still think of the world in terms of trickle down. And so if employers have more money, they will eventually hire more people, they'll pass those wages on, and so on. That means if you're trying to increase the minimum wage or improve benefits and all of that, you're in an uphill battle because you're thinking, oh, well, gee, I'd love all those things, but if the employer doesn't have money to give, then, you know, those jobs are going to be at risk. And so the narrative work became about trying to flip that cognitive model and figure out, well, how do you have a different understanding of how money flows in society, and so to be able to get to a point really where we're talking about the idea, you know, businesses don't create jobs, customers create jobs. So when people have more money, they spend it, and that's really how we thrive. So that was communications to a particular end. That was communications. This is if we change this fundamental cognitive model that people have in mind, we then set up a whole host of progressive economic policies to follow. Because then anything we suggest that puts more money in people's pockets, makes families better off, is going to be better for all of us. So real reform involved there, not just feeling better about the economy, not just turning, you know, one group against another group and so on. And I think that's the challenge I would put out there as we think about the hard work we have to do in healing our democracy, that if it's not enough to just remind people of the things the government does, it's not enough to talk about what taxes are and what they're for. That's certainly part of what we have to do. But unless we are also providing inspiration to get engaged, real reform that invites action, that allows people to own their change and recognize government is us and model that behavior and give people those opportunities for action. In the long run, that's really the only way that we're going to heal our democracy. Otherwise, we're just waiting for another guy like Trump who will go in there and say what we want to say and punch the people in the nose that we want to have punched in the nose. That's who's going to act on my behalf because I can't do it for myself. We're setting ourselves up for more of that in the future unless we give people more of those openings for change.
Thanks, Meg. So does anyone want to weigh in on what Meg just laid out there? I have another question, but it looked like Jesse was leaning in.
No, I'm just a lot of agreement, just a lot of head nodding.
So again, I think we're almost out of time, but I definitely want to encourage questions from the audience members. And as we're waiting for more, I think one of the biggest tensions I think for philanthropy is the privilege that philanthropy has, although it's outsized from government, but it is a privilege in terms of shaping culture and moving policy change. How do the funders on the call think about philanthropy's privilege related to democracy, in particular in context of understanding that there is all this anxiety about elites and domination? How do you balance your privilege with the understanding that philanthropy's outsized role in shifting culture?
I think one, for me, I feel like philanthropy needs to be a little bit more participatory. We are part of the One Oregon Narrative Project, meaning we are struggling with the same questions that folks who will be implementing it are struggling with, number one. I think number two, and Eric sort of made this point, when folks were talking about Y2K, like, they were actually talking about the year 2050, and philanthropy is like too notorious for thinking in 12-month grant cycles. And so I think the idea that we are in a long-term project to fix our democracy is one we have to keep reminding ourselves, not grant outcomes based on 12 months. Not that we can't mark our progress along the way, but I think that those two things: one, you're not an investor; you're also a participant. So, shifting that the way you are complicit in the change, and accomplice to the change, and then into embracing what long term actually means, and knowing that the forces that are working, that have worked to get us to this place in terms of such a distrust in our democracy, have been at it for a long time, and they kept at it for a long time. And it was very much a narrative project. and we have to keep that same commitment.
Eric, I wonder if you want to weigh in, and then I will close us out after you weigh in.
So, you know, It's a hard one, right? So I also want to recognize the, you know, the limitations of philanthropic resources and, you know, and I think the need to be responsive to current challenges. And, you know, I think philanthropic institutions juggle a lot, but I think it is critical for philanthropy to stop thinking about demographic change as something that is going to be happening down the line. It is actually happening now. It has happened. And so is the anxiety that comes with it. And so I think we need to put ourselves in the moment. Two, we have to be willing to take some chances with new models. So we have to be open. At least some of our resources have to be set loose for experimentation that may end in failure, but provide learnings. And I think that piece is really critical. Three, you know, let's be clear. If we are talking about the disaffected populations amongst us, they have to have a role inside of philanthropy. They are going to be the individuals with the most perspective on what is happening and what that looks like. It doesn't mean others don't have a role to play, but that voice is really missing inside of philanthropy, and we suffer from it. Fourth, we have to build new types of coalitions, and unique coalitions that we may not have put together. And those coalitions may look really strange and uncomfortable, but I think that they are really important. And finally, the last is this. We cannot repeat some of the failures we have done in the past, which is in organizing disaffected white communities. We have left organizations of color and leaders of color out of that equation, yeah. Right? If we are training leadership within communities of color, this is a skill set that they must have. They have to have the skill set. They have to have the resources to strategize. We cannot put communities of color back into another box that says that their only expertise and leadership is within their communities. They are democracy's future leaders, and we have to set the stage for them to be able to lead with their white cohorts on this issue. Last, this is not a number, but I envy those of you in the Pacific Northwest, because I think there is such an opportunity, there is such space to come up with learnings for the rest of the nation. And I don't get away from the hard challenge that really exists in trying to figure out how to do this right.
Thank you so much. Thank you to Eric, Jesse, and Meg for joining me today. I hope you all will stay safe and sane for the next several weeks. Always feel free to stay off Twitter and think about the long term. I think that will keep us a lot healthier and will improve our democracy. I want to mention a couple of things in terms of resources and then just a little bit of follow-up. At Philanthropy Northwest, we have an initiative called Democracy Northwest, which is really exploring the nexus between philanthropy and democracy, understanding the role of democracy in trying to create a more philanthropy in trying to create a more reflective democracy and exploring what next steps we might take. And we've been talking to many of the members about what that might look like. There is a written document about this work by one of our former members, Dan Kemmes, that we'll send out as a link in the follow-up email. In my role as Advocacy Catalyst Fellow, I'm going to be putting on all sorts of programming like this over the next year. So I definitely encourage folks to reach out to me with examples, case studies, questions that you want to explore in terms of advocacy and public policy. We will be sending out a link to the recording of this webinar to all of you. So look for that in addition to all the other resources, and we'll also include a link to the webinar that Jesse mentioned.